From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For close to 40 years, our guest tonight, filmmaker John Waters, has been shooting to shock on the silver screen. His plots are always arrestingly off-key, from apple pie mom turns serial killer to Unchained gross-out contests, to a musical on the rivalry between squares and greasers that you will not confuse with American Graffiti. What Waters' films all share is the gritty shock, horror, sex, and outrageous edge that has earned him the titles of the Pope of Trash, the Sultan of Sleaze, the Baron of Bad Taste.
And more than the sight of it, I love the taste of it, the taste of hot, freshly killed blood.
Could you give us some of your political beliefs?
Kill everyone now. Condone first-degree murder. Advocate cannibalism. Eat. Filth are my politics. Filth is my life. Take whatever you like.
John Waters started his career in the angry underground with low-budget silent films. His actors were a wild ensemble of counterculture friends he called the Dreamlanders. PR was word of mouth, and midnight church halls served as his theaters. Then came his cult favorite kink classics Pink Flamingos and Female Trouble. Now his more recent films, Hairspray, Crybaby Pecker, and Serial Mom, are watched worldwide. And his casts include big-name actors like Kathleen Turner, Johnny Depp, and Melanie Griffith, alongside seamy pop culture icons like Patty Hearst, ex-porn star Tracy Lords, and TV talk show host Ricky Lake. John Waters is now touring the country with his one-man show, World of Trash. We caught up with him earlier today. John Waters, welcome to On Point.
Well, thank you for having me.
You are back in the news. You've got your 1974 film Female Trouble coming out in a re-release, and you've got a new one-man show, World of Trash.
Right.
What's John Waters up to these days?
Well, I also have a Broadway musical opening August 15th at Hairspray.
That's right, your first remake. You went from the real wild country to Hollywood, and now from Hollywood to Broadway.
Yeah, I know. I'm a multifaceted kind of guy here. You know, I'm trying to turn Pink Flamingos into a children's show.
We don't think that's going to happen.
Well, you know, it would work if you just cut out the sex and just have the gross-out battle. It would work.
Oh, gosh. You know, I saw Pink Flamingos when I was probably 17 or 18 years old.
Did it scar you for life?
Well, the images have never left me, John Waters.
Well, and it's you. Good.
They have never left. My God. It was wild. What's given you this big burst of activity lately?
I'm always doing something. You know, I've been doing actually this lecture circuit for 30 years, if you want to know the truth. It evolved into something very different, but I've done comedy club tours. I've played in punk rock clubs. I've done it for a long time. I've kept rewriting it and keep changing and everything until it's turned into what it is today. They pick the World of Trash. I usually send them a whole, like, 20 titles they can pick from, what they'd like to call it in their community. I always like This Filthy World, but no one ever picks that title. So I let the people that bring me pick the title.
Tell us about your one-man show, World of Trash. What do you deliver?
It's a monologue, and it's a stand-up monologue about the independent film business. It's also about all my obsessions, fashion, murderers, trials, all my movies. And what it's like to live in Baltimore, you know, it's about every single thing, whatever's obsessing me this week. You know, I always put in new things. I'm always obsessed by something. That's why I've always had a fairly happy life, because I'm always find new interests to dwell on.
Yes, you do. And yet there are those consistent themes, John Waters. And World of Trash seems to capture that. Take us to the heart of your lifetime obsession, I guess, with the other side of the tracks, with the World of Trash, with kitsch and violence and bizarreness.
Rebellion. I mean, I was born in an upper middle class family. It was probably everything my parents didn't want me to do. I mean, I'm certainly sure that when I was a baby, they didn't talk about me growing up to be the Prince of Puke or the Anal Ambassador or some of the other names that I've been given.
That's our boy.
But I was born 2 months early, so something was a matter right in the beginning. Some people have said I was overly baptized, which could be true, because when you're born 2 months early, you get baptized every 10 minutes. So there's not a trace of original sin left in me, and maybe I needed to get a little back.
Well, you got it back in spades. With Female Trouble coming out, of course, it means divine coming back to the screen.
Right? It's very strange, especially with Hairspray. You know, this week I was in New York, and we did a photo shoot for Vanity Fair for it, and Harvey Fierstein plays Divine in it, and he's wonderful. He doesn't imitate Divine in any way, but he has the same great appeal. He's a fine, fine actor. Still, it was very, very strange for me to walk in for the first time, and Harvey's actually getting in drag, because at all the rehearsals, of course, he's not in drag. And you see it, and it's very Twilight Zone-ish. I think Divine dead would be very proud of it. Alive, he'd want the part.
For our listeners who don't know John Waters films, and there must only be one or two.
I'm sure
only one or two, but describe Divine. How did you connect with Divine, the unbelievable Divine?
He was never in drag except when he did movies or someone paid him. He wasn't a transvestite in real life at all. Mm-hmm. He was a character actor. None of my movies was the parts that Divine played. A reveal that he was a man. That never had anything to do with it. I mean, Hairspray, the video, is rented all the time for children's birthday parties. Kids don't know that's a man. It's not part of the plot. Mm-hmm. Divine actually grew up the street from my parents and his parents. I met him when they moved there when we were in high school. He was hassled a lot in school, and I gave him a kind of a venue for the anger he had from that to turn into this fictitious character, Divine, who was kind of Jane Mansfield and Godzilla put together. Divine was always overweight, but drag queens were very square then. They wanted to be Bess Meyerson and their mother and wear mink coats. And Divine would carry a chainsaw, and he made fun of drag queens. Now all drag queens are hip. I mean, there's no such thing as a square drag queen anymore. But mostly they all have a sense of humor about it, and they're all hip in a way. And none of them used to be, really. So I think we can thank him for that. That's, I think a very nice gift to society.
The unforgettable Divine, and for people who haven't seen Divine in the movies, the enormous presence. I don't know how much he weighed, but this was a big fellow in drag, always with the beehive hairdo.
Well, but not always. I mean, if you think about it, Divine started in my early movies playing a psychotic lunatic, but the end in Hairspray, he was a blue-collar mother, and he looked anything like a drag queen. He almost had no makeup on, and the neighborhood women in a blue-collar neighborhood thought he was one of them on the set. They'd say hello to him and stuff. They had absolutely no idea he was a man.
Penny, your mother called all frantic. She said you were punished.
I'm always punished.
And Tracy, I have told you about that hair. All ratted up like a teenage Jezebel.
Oh, Mother, you're so 50s.
Tracy's flamboyant flip is all the rage, Miss Edna. Jackie Kennedy, our first lady, even rats her hair.
But Tracy ain't no first lady, are you, Tracy? No, sirree. She's a hair hopper. That's what she is. Now, I've got nothing but hampers of ironing to do, and my diet pill is wearing off.
What do you make of this migration of social perceptions of folks in drag from the early 70s till now? There's been a big change.
Well, drag now is on television. I mean, drag is hardly startling anymore. That's why my last few movies I've had drag kings, which I find these days more exciting. Women dressed as men, especially women that dress as men that look like handsome gay men, and they go to gay bars, and then gay men try to pick them up, and it's like terrorism. It really is good. But because drag queens now are on television, they're on sitcoms, so it doesn't have the edge it had at one point.
John Waters, how does that affect the way people see your earlier films? Do you find that to younger audiences today they are less shocking than they were to audiences in the 70s?
No, actually, Pink Flamingos never mellowed. It, in some ways, because of political correctness, even more appalling. I mean, it came out, I guess it's been 5 years now, for the 25th anniversary of it, and it became the number two best-selling video in America. When I do appearances, I would say the average age is in the 20s to come. So that's the crossover for me. You know, kids are great. They respect exploitation and weird movies and everything. They know more about them than my generation does in some ways.
When people come out of Pink Flamingos, what's the reaction that you've seen over time? What's the reaction you are or were looking for?
Well, at the time when Pink Flamingos was made, which was 1971, actually, and it came out in 72, you have to remember that was the year Deep Throat came out. That's when Porno Chic happened. I was trying to make a movie to shock and surprise the hippie audience who would come to see it in the first place. It was a punk movie made for hippies, even though I didn't even know it. It was for angry hippies. When that movie first became successful, I would say it was not a completely gay audience at all. It was a third gay people that didn't like other gay people. Mm-hmm. It was a third bikers and a third hippies that were angry. That was how it's always been my audience. It still is.
That cookie was asking questions, Crackers. I heard her.
She's right, Ma. She's right. But why would she send us a turd?
Who knows? Who knows? These are obviously jealous people. Jealous of our careers, of all of our press. Why else would they sign that, the filthiest people alive? Everyone knows that title has become my trademark. Why do you use it in this way is only to insinuate that they are filthier than I. How could anyone seriously believe that? How could anyone be filthier than Divine? I'm afraid our little vacation must come to an end. This must be nipped in the bud. It's already out of hand.
So there you go. It's the classic formula. And it had everything. Men with chickens, violence of every bizarre variety. The human anatomy was not spared any orifice there.
Well, I don't have a lot of missionary sex in my movies because everybody else does that.
You say, in a way, it was for angry hippies.
With a sense of humor.
Of course.
Angry people without a sense of humor. Well, when you're young, you can be angry without a sense of humor, like most political radicals are, and they get away with it with a certain style.
If you didn't have sense of humor, you didn't make it through that movie, though. If you weren't laughing, you were probably gone at some point.
No, it was a litmus test, Bessie. It was a good first date. You either knew that you were either definitely going to get laid or the person would never speak to you again.
It had its stripe of violence, and you've never been afraid of that. Female Trouble had plenty. You also talked about this sort of angry hippie crowd at that time. We've come a long way on the violence front as a society since the 70s. No, I don't think in the humor thing. I'm thinking of Columbine. I'm thinking the way that alienation, that disenfranchisement, that maybe folks who were angry hippies in the 70s or at least the alienated went to see Pink Flamingos. At Columbine, we saw something else entirely, you know, pipe bombers and terrorism and office shootings and school massacres. Does it change the way you think about violence? Has it affected the way you use it?
Maybe they didn't get to see Pink Flamingos. Mm-hmm. Maybe they didn't have an outlet for their violence, which I did. I made movies and made fun of it. I don't think my films ever cause violence. Are you kidding? Nobody's that dumb when they see a movie and think, did that person get hurt?
Do you feel like a transition, a migration in the way our society holds violence in its mind, in its hands, responds to it in the movies?
I guess it's had 20, 30 more years of people to get picked on and get more and more angry about it, and the teachers don't do anything about it. I mean, Divine got beat up every day in school, and the teachers were horrible to him when he would try to get help. You can see how that thing happens. I understand the anger that leads to insanity that this kind of thing happens, and I think it's much better today. I think as horrible as Columbine was, it probably did lead to at least some teachers and other kids maybe backing off a little.
Why do you think the violence is there in a day when we've got all the political correctness, when there are, you know, support groups for homosexuals in high school?
But only in rich kids' schools, I promise you. In the ghetto, they do not have a gay rights organization. In poor white schools, political correctness is only a luxury of rich people. Mm-hmm. It has no effect. No one's even heard of that in Baltimore, in certain neighborhoods. I mean, it's not even an option. It is meaningless.
What about the voice of those who don't have the money? Is it heard any louder today than it was when you started making films? You've clearly got a big chunk of empathy for those people in all your films.
Sure. I mean, when I was young, the people who didn't have money turned into Black Panthers, or there was all sorts of protest movements going on. So there was quite an outlet for it. I mean, there was so many causes, and that's how people met each other, and that's how they joined up. Today, there's less. I mean, we have kind of world economy kind of thing. But after 9/11, that was a tough one. You know, that sort of took the wind out of those sails, I think. And it isn't as easy. It's more conformity today than it was when I was young in some ways. However, it's better because kids today, they don't even care if people are gay. They don't even know. It's not even an issue anymore. But that, once again, is in rich kids' schools. But it is very different today. It is more liberal. I mean, you see what's on television. People even know what a gay person is. I mean, when I was growing up, people didn't even know what that was in some places. So I think it's much, much better than when I was young. I'm hardly nostalgic for the past. I think young people today make great movies. They have a good sense of humor. They're funny. They look great. And if I was young, I'm sure I'd have my whole mouth outlined in studs.
I'm sure you would. But that whole era when things were more repressed and more underground certainly gave you a big, big target to shoot at.
Well, there's still a big target to shoot at. I mean, you know, every single kid's parents, I mean, you can figure out. I talk about in my lecture how to get on your parents' nerves in a new creative way, how to be a juvenile delinquent. We don't have Wilding is not being a juvenile delinquent. Juvenile delinquents are quaint today compared to what that used to mean in the 50s. I mean, parents wish their kids would only once steal a hubcap.
Just once, Johnny, steal a hubcap.
I mean, at least, you know, and I don't trust anybody that's never been in trouble. I mean, most everyone I know is arrested once. I think it's good for you as you grow up.
Folks, we're talking with John Waters, director of, well, a string of films like no other string of films, from Pink Flamingos to Serial Mom Pecker, Cecil B. Demented in the year 2000, always with a unique view of the world. Prince of Puke, John Waters. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
got lots of problems. Team Hail Trouble.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Our picture is called Raving Beauty. You play the insane owner of a failed art theater who, along with her film fanatic boyfriend, Lyle, come on over, and her violence-prone daughter, Cherish, together, the three of you vow to start a revolution to destroy mainstream cinema.
I can't be in this movie.
You dare to tell Cecil B. DeMented you refuse? How's this for motivation, huh?
Ow!
There are no creative differences on a Cecil B. DeMented set, Miss Whitlock. You got that? One day you'll thank me for saving you from your bad career. Places!
That from the John Waters film of 2000, Cecil B. DeMented. We're talking this hour with director John Waters. John Waters, you've always had a testy relationship with Hollywood. You've had your own stripe, your own way to go. In Cecil B. DeMented, you had the insane film director. He kidnaps a big-time movie star.
Right.
Honey Whitlock was played by Melanie Griffith and forces her to be in his movie, a wild epic called Raving Beauty. What is your relationship with Hollywood, John Waters?
Oh, it's just fine. You know, I think in Cecil B. DeMented, I made fun of myself, really, about what do you have to do to be edgy anymore? Do I have to light my hair on fire on the stage of the Coolidge Corner to prove that I haven't sold out? Hollywood's been fine to me. I guess, you know, the difference between independent film and a Hollywood film is really close today. There's not much difference, basically. It's just how much money you have. If you have $6, $7, $8 million to make a movie, it doesn't matter who made it. They're going to make you test it. They're going to give you notes, and they're going to have an opinion about it. That's the reality of the game. It's better now. I mean, Hollywood, in a way, is looking for weird movies. You know, things like American Beauty win the Oscar, unheard of, like 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But still, the independent world is where I'm more comfortable. I mean, they know how to market my films better. I'm the host of the Independent Spirit Awards every year in L.A. So, but I go pitch my movies in Hollywood exactly like in The Player. So I think the people that run the studios now respect my career because I've been doing it for so long. They don't always say yes to me because they get to greenlight three movies a year. If they don't make money, they lose their job.
Well, let me ask you this. Did you watch the Oscars this year?
Of course. I was at the Elton John's dinner party for the Oscars and at the Vanity Fair party.
And what do you think of what you see coming across the screen when we get the clips of the Oscars? You know the films that are up there.
Well, some of them I like, some don't. I'm a member of the Academy. I vote.
Your fingerprints are all over those Oscars, then.
Yeah, actually, I'm not allowed to say if I voted for one, but some years what I voted for is one. So I love being a member of the Academy. You get thousands of free tapes of every movie, and my house becomes Blockbuster Video. Everybody borrows them.
So there you are.
I'm serious about it. I'm not against Hollywood. I don't want to live there because I would lose whatever minor power I have because they'd be used to seeing me. Because when I go there to sell a movie, I go for a week. I'm either there, they're going to do it or not. If they see me at every party, every weekend, then they can wait.
I've always wanted to know how you made that passage, that transition from the far fringes where you started with Pink Flamingos and Female Trouble through Hairspray, Crybaby, Serial Mom. Describe for us your journey from the real outlier places to Central Hollywood.
I always search for a place that would show my films, that's all. I've been reading trade papers since I was 12 years old. I am a businessman, too. Why I made underground movies in the beginning, because that was the only possible way I could know how to do it.
Pink Flamingos on $12,000.
Oh, way before that. That was later. We're talking about, that's sort of getting to independent film.
Okay.
No, that's midnight movies. Underground films came first.
Okay.
Like my really early ones, like Mondo Trasho and stuff. And then sort of midnight movies, which were Pink Flamingos. Then they didn't have them anymore, so I made Polyester when video came out. The midnight movies were over. And so that was my first R-rated movie that could sort of play everybody. It was in everywhere. It was in Odorama. And then I accidentally made a family movie, Hairspray, which gave me an entree into Hollywood, which the only real Hollywood movie I guess I made was Crybaby because it was Universal distributed by.
Well, what do you mean accidentally about Hairspray?
I was shocked when I got a PG rating. I thought I'd never work again. But at the same time, the distributor said, well, you have to put in a dirty word so you'll get a PG-13. I said, no, let's have the shock of it be that it is a John Waters movie for the whole family. And I remember the best review we ever got on that film said that it was a movie all families could love, the Bradys and the Mansons.
Hi, Mom. Penny Pingleton, you know you are punished. From now on, you're wearing a giant P on your blouse every day to school so that the whole world knows that Penny Pingleton is permanently, positively punished. Bye, Miss Edna.
Bye, honey.
Were you ever on blacklists because of your earlier films? Were there reviewers who did not want you to succeed? No, I just, were there critics who did not want you to succeed because of where you started?
Oh, I promise you.
Is that true?
Many critics that, Pink Flamingos didn't even get reviewed for 2 years. They wouldn't even review it, much less not give it a bad review. That was totally word of mouth, that movie. That would be impossible today. Pink Flamingos today would have to have open on 80 screens at least and have an advertising budget and a print campaign and prints and, you know, budgets and stuff. No, I'm not saying I was ever totally accepted, but I kept kind of reinventing myself. For, you know, you have to do that in show business. If I was still making gross-out Pink Flamingos, nobody makes gross-out movies now except Hollywood. It's come full circle. Kids don't make gross-out movies. Hollywood does.
In 1990, you made Cry Baby, and you've got Johnny Depp, of course, as the heartthrob and the whole 50s setting and the good upper-class girl who falls in love with the wild boy. Mm-hmm. What's the difference between an American Graffiti and a Crybaby? What's the core sensibility that makes them different?
Well, I can give you a few things. I mean, the ingenue when Crybaby leaves or cries into a jar and drinks the tears.
That's different.
Shading. It's all about shading.
It's all about shading. But why does American Graffiti become kind of an instant mass market hit? And yeah. Crybaby, tremendously appealing film, but it's coming at it from an edge. What's that unique edge?
I remember when we tested Crybaby, all these teenage girls showed up that were in love with Johnny Depp, and they smelled a rat correctly, me, because we were making fun of him being a teenage idol. And he used to come to me and say, I hate being on 21 Jump Street. I hate being a teen idol. And
right.
I said, well, stick with us. We'll kill that. And we killed it in the way that he wanted to be killed, because then Tim Burton came in and put him in Edward Scissorhands, and his whole career went into a completely different way. We're always infected with irony, and some audiences hate irony. Mass audiences hate irony because they think you're making fun of them, and you are.
What's the matter, Crybaby?
Everything's the matter.
It's just a thunderstorm. Heat lightning, it's sexy.
It's not sexy. Electricity makes me insane.
Why, Crybaby? Why?
Here's why. Electricity killed my parents.
They died in the electric chair?
That's right, Alice. My father was the alphabet bomber. He may have been crazy, but he was my pop.
God, I heard about the alphabet bomber. Bombs exploding in the airport and barbershop.
That's right. All in alphabetical order. I used to lay in my cradle and hear him scream in his sleep. A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Boom! Boom!
But your mom...
My mother tried to stop him. She couldn't even spell, for Christ's sake, but they fried her, too. But I'll pay them all back, Allison. And that's why every day I gotta do something rotten for my parents' sake, and I'll cry for what I have to do. But not much, though. One single salty tear is all they'll ever suck out of this crybaby.
No doubt about it. But yet, the kids on the Johnny Depp side of the tracks, your affection for them is
yeah, well, Crybaby still probably is the film that more people have ever seen in the world that I made, because it plays on television constantly all over the world because of Johnny Depp. Yeah, because you're talking about, I had someone named Hatchet Face in it. American Graffiti had it, Suzanne Summers, when she was very, very young. Now, I had Suzanne Summers in Serial Mom, too. I love Suzanne Summers, but we always put them in different contexts.
Talk to us about Serial Mom. Kathleen Turner, of course, is the mom who just knocks them over one after another.
Well, it's a fantasy if you could actually literally kill every person that got on your nerves every day and not feel guilty about it. For little things. Everybody could make a list of five little things that gets on your nerves. But it was a comedy. It's safe up on the movie screen. You know, it's not real. So everybody knows there's a great, great freedom of the difference between the size of a movie theater, that what you could do in real life could be so horrible and put it up on a movie screen, and it's hilarious. And that is the luxury of entertainment.
You can't wear white shoes after Labor Day.
That's not true anymore.
Yes, it is. Didn't your mother ever tell you? Now you know.
No, please. Fashion has changed.
No, it hasn't.
Do you trust that this is the fantasy of some portion of the American public to knock off anybody who gets in their way?
I didn't say everybody that gets in their way. I said everybody that gets on their nerves.
Who offends their sense of how the world ought to be, I guess.
And if you could, in your mind, I don't mean you really do it, but every day you think, oh, God, you know, I mean, there's somebody that gets on your nerves. And, of course, literally, I don't mean that you want them dead. But why is there such an expression as, I could kill her? You know, I mean, but this is, she just took it literally. It was a comedy. It was based on, I have about 10,000 true crime books. I was, for a long time, went to trials all around the country before Court TV ruined it. I mean, they didn't ruin it. They made it great for everybody else, but they made it very unexclusive. It used to be very hard to get in a good murder trial. So I used up my obsession with that. Whenever I finally make a movie about something, my obsession with it is usually finally satiated. Mm.
Patty Hearst has shown up in a number of your films. How did your relationship with Patty Hearst begin, and how do you see her as an actor? What does she bring to your films?
Well, I think she's a good comedian. That's why I use her. I think she's a great member of like a repertoire group. She's also my very dear friend. But I didn't know her. I was obsessed by her case, and I went to her trial. I did not know her, and she didn't even know that until many, many years later when we actually met. And she said, it's people like you while I went to prison because you wanted me to be something I never was. And she's right. And I met her in Cannes, and someone knew that I was obsessed by her, so they purposely sat me near her at a dinner. That's what film festivals are for, aren't they? I guess it's called networking.
Right. What is Patty Hearst like? So many of us only know her from her very early kidnapping and the whole Symbionese thing.
Whatever she did, she made the right decision. She's alive, and they're dead or on trial for murder.
What's her personality, John Waters?
Well, she doesn't think that's funny. I mean, no one's ever going to tell Patty Hearst what to do again unless you're a good director and use your words with care. But she is funny. She has a great sense of humor about other things, and she's a very good friend. She came with me to the Independent Spirit Awards. I see her a lot, and I like her very, very much.
Hi, kid. Remember, always look both ways before crossing.
Mother!
We're having your favorite supper tonight, Wanda. Potatoes au gratin.
Mmm!
Now walk. Look left. Look right. That's right. Then walk. Good teenagers.
Your storyline in Cecil B. Demented partly, you know, sort of parallels her own kidnapping. Did she give you tips on that? What did she think of your rendition?
She didn't have to give me tips, but after we filmed the scene, she said, did my mother say those exact words? I said, no, I wouldn't have had that bad a taste to do that. She said basically the same thing. Who wants to be a famous victim? If you make fun of it, they can't say it, and they can't use it against you anymore. The same reason Tracy Lords played a bad girl with me, the same reason Johnny Depp played a teen idol. If you make fun of what they use against you, they can't use it against you anymore.
John Waters, Hollywood and films always play this line between saying something honest and true about society and giving us an enormous continent of illusion to play in. What's the ratio today compared to when you began making films? Are films more honest, more unreal? Does it matter to you? Do you think about it?
I don't care. I mean, it's just if they have style and the director believes in it. I love any director that takes you into his world, even if you hate his world. I prefer movies that are written and directed by the same person. I like directors that use the same actors over and over. My favorite movies recently were The Piano Teacher. I like the Mexican movie about the kids. What's it called?
Itulia.
Yeah. I usually like weird movies, foreign films, independent films. But I haven't seen Spider-Man yet, but I'm happy it's great. I mean, Willem Dafoe I hear is wonderful in it, and Toby I've met before. So it's not that I dislike Hollywood movies, but it's not the first ones I go see. You know, I like the arty ones. I'm an arty kind of guy.
Who's coming up on that side that you like to watch these days?
Well, you know, I really liked Woody Allen's new movie, and I really want to say that because I keep reading, like, some of these reviews.
Everyone slams it.
It's great and funny and hilarious, and they're going to go crazy for it opening night in Cannes, which it is. Because it's got really good French jokes, and I like the French, too.
your film, Pecker, deals with unexpected fame.
Yep.
You've got fame at this point. How does the whole notion of director as star that we've seen in the movies is developed so much?
Well, I used it as, because I didn't have anything else to sell in the old days. I mean, we didn't have stars. We didn't have anything. So we tried to create this persona, Divine and I did, and we would travel around the country and introduce the movies. And I would come out dressed like a hippie pimp, and I would praise nudist camp movies and all sorts of cinematically incorrect genres of film, and then Devine would come out and drag, pushing a shopping cart full of dead mackerels and throw them in the audience. And then in each city, the cutest guy that we'd meet, we'd put a short-haired wig on him. They always had long hair then, and dress him as a cop, and the cop would come on stage to try to bust us, and Devine would strangle the cop to death. That was our act. And it just went from there. I don't know.
You've talked about good bad taste and bad bad taste. What's the difference?
That was good bad taste.
Well, how do you draw the line between the two?
Good bad taste has some wit. It looks up to the subject matter. It doesn't condescend. I'm against yuppies that have pink flamingos on their lawn. Offends me. Real people that work in carnivals, that work hard, that have them in front of their trailer, I think it looks beautiful. It's a big difference. It's about shading.
And how about shock and edge, the way they're played out on the screen today? You've pointed out that the movie, There's Something About Mary, has been sort of a benchmark in recent shock value. Is
and
it
that was a great one. And then there were lots of terrible ones.
Such as?
Well, I'm never going to name it. I never say anything bad about somebody in the movie business, because then I'll sit next to them.
It'll only come back to you. But what made it good, I guess?
I don't like those movies, but they're broader than my movies. My movies are never that commercial. My films have always been foreign films, even in America.
What's the quality that makes them foreign films here?
Because they're for an outsider that never wins. So there's always a certain part of the audience that does not identify, maybe. Maybe that's it. And maybe just some people don't like them. You know, you can't, as the harder you try to make something that everyone likes, I think the less chance you have of somebody really liking it. If everybody in the world said, oh, it was okay, that's not really what I'm looking for.
When you look at other sort of sci-fi alienation films, Matrix, do you identify with that kind of outsider?
That is the genre I know the least about. I've never seen a Star Wars movie, and I wouldn't know if it was good.
What about
I don't like them. I don't get it. And it's special effects, it's the least thing I'm looking for in a movie.
What about on television? Anything that grabs you there these days?
No, actually, I read all the time. I used to like Homicide a lot. I thought it was a good, gritty movie. And there is a lot of TV shows that people tell me I would love, but I read every night. And
South Park hasn't reached out and grabbed your collar,
John
Waters?
I love South Park, but I like South Park, the movie. Yeah, I love South Park. I think it's funny. But I'm not a TV junkie because I get 140 magazines a month now, and I read a lot of books. So I read every night. That's how I relax. For a TV to be on in my house makes me insane. I've had love affairs break up because of it.
We're talking with the Sultan of Sleaze, director John Waters. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Oh, what a town. You know, I tell everybody in Hollywood that if you want to shoot on location in Baltimore, you really don't need to bring a crew from Los Angeles. Because Baltimore really is best.
Melanie Griffith in Cecil B. DeMille, the year 2000 film by director John Waters. John Waters, what is it with you in Baltimore? You just can't get over the place.
Well, I mean, to me, Baltimore is a character in my movies. It inspires me. My house is here. My office is here. But I also live in New York. I spend the summer in Provincetown. So it's not like I'm here every second. But when I need to be inspired, whenever I start writing something, I come here. And I know it's in this town. And I drive around and I spy on people. And I sit out front of their house and make notes. And people think I'm a weird insurance inspector or something. But it's all here. And I just have to get the ideas from being here because it's the real world. It's the only city where I visit where everybody thinks they're normal, but they're totally insane. Where in Provincetown and New York and everywhere else, everybody thinks they're insane, but in some ways they're very normal.
What is it about Baltimore that is your conduit to the world of trash? Is Baltimore trashier than others, or you just know
it's
the trash
side? Trashy. Yeah, it is trashy, and I mean that as a great compliment. We do low really well. We do fancy terribly, but New York does low really badly. It's faux low. So I have great places. All my New York friends come down here, and they're speechless when we go to some of these places.
This is so low. This is such fine low.
But we do low really, really brilliantly.
And the hair. You've talked lovingly about the way Baltimore ladies manage their hair.
Well, the beehives are long gone, I promise you. Farrah Fawcett's hairdo still reigns fairly supreme here, though. That hairdo is 3 out of 5 checkout women at my food store have a Farrah Fawcett hairdo, and not a subtle one. A major roller mark.
Once again, your hairdo is getting you in hot water. Didn't 2 weeks in hairdo detention have any effect?
I happen to be the height of teen fashion.
You're on a one-way ticket to reform school. Well, I'm afraid we're just going to have to change your homeroom. Starting today, you report to Class 10D, room 108.
Special ed?
Yes, Miss Turnblad. Special education. Here, you will be taught by specialists trained to deal with hairdo scofflaws in high school society.
Mr. Davidson!
That will be all, Miss Turnblad.
That's Baltimore, and that's hair. John Waters, in a funny way, the arc of your movies, for myself, I track something about maturation in there. In my own life, what about you? Have you mellowed, or is it a mellower John Waters, or just a John Waters that's still pursuing the audience?
Well, I'm happy. I've said it a million times, but a 50-some-year-old man that's angry is an asshole, basically. Angry is cute when you're 20. I don't have a lot to be mad about. I've made 13 movies. I've written 4 books. I have a Broadway play coming out. I do lecture tours. I have a photo career. I mean, I'm doing what I like, and I've never had to get a real job. I can still wear my underpants to work if I have to.
And the play, how's it translating to the stage? Have you dropped in?
It's completely new. I mean, it's all new music written by Mark Shaiman and Scott Whitman, who did South Park the movie. It's got a great director, Jack O'Brien, great choreographer, Jerry Mitchell. I mean, it's got top Broadway people doing it. And we had the big press day in New York the other day where they showed 5 musical numbers totally choreographed and everything. Not costumes yet, but totally choreographed and everybody singing, dancing. It was amazing to me.
As they've waded into Hairspray, how does it look like it translates to Broadway? Is this going to be?
I think very well. I'm incredibly proud of it. It opens August 15th at the Neil Simon Theater. That'll be a scary night.
Are you an habitué of Broadway when you're in New York?
Not a lot. I mean, my favorite play I saw this year was Edward Albee's The Goat. But I don't see everything at all, no. I've been seeing a lot more lately because, being into this new world, which is fascinating to me to see what happens, how you get a Broadway show up there. I know how you get a movie made. Until this, I did not know how you get a Broadway play up there. And it's an amazing process that has gone very, very well so far.
Step back global for a second with us. I don't know if your vision translates that way, but after 9/11, we saw anger played out on a big scale, sort of dwarfs everything we've known in this country.
Yeah.
What do you make of that, John Waters, the director who's thought a lot about, folks on the other side of the tracks and anger and acting anger out?
Well, I was in New York. I live on 12th Street, so I wasn't that far away from it. I saw it happen. Of course, I'm never going to forget it for the rest of my life. I'll never forget. I was standing there on 6th Avenue, and the guy next to me said, stranger, said, I'm moving to Montana. And the guy on the other side of me said, well, they got it this time. And because, they had bombed it before. So what do I think? Do I understand why people hate us? Yes. I didn't turn me into a right-wing flag-waving lunatic. It certainly made me be very proud to be an American, but I understand how some of this has happened, and certainly since it's happened, understand a lot more. It's still amazing. I mean, I live in New York, too, so I think, every time I look up, every time I go on the train from Baltimore, New York, and you don't see the World Trade Center anymore, it is still staggering, and it's almost like, keep a leaf, did that really happen? I mean, and to be honest, I don't think they ever thought that they were going to collapse. I think it worked better than they ever imagined it was going to work. I don't understand why they never mentioned bin Laden anymore.
being the United States.
Catch him,
right, so he's gone.
Don't bring it up anymore.
if you don't see him, he's not there.
And they had in Baltimore something. I mean, you say, can you ever have humor about this? Well, in the post office, where near where I live in this Hamden, the neighborhood we've made Pecker, they had a wanted poster of Bin Laden. And I thought, well, this is really, do you think he's really living here up the street by the laundromat wearing a turban looking like this? I mean, it did make me laugh. There's still, I guess, in some horrible things, you can always find something that can be humorous in a terrible way. But if you can't cry, sometimes you have to laugh.
Can you imagine ever bringing Bin Laden into one of your films?
No, I doubt it. I'm sure he hates all movies, doesn't he? He has to sin to go to the movies, if you believe in what I'm doing. It's like one time they asked me, I was at a film festival, and this Iranian guy said, we'd like to give you a tribute in Tehran, but we could never, ever show Cyril my film. You should see the other ones. You could show them in alphabetical order and then, you know, execute me on the closing night. It would be quite a tribute.
John Waters, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
If you're in the Boston area, John Waters will be performing his one-man show, World of Trash, and premiering the director's cut of his film, Female Trouble, at the Coolidge Corner Theater tomorrow night at 8:30. For more information, go to our website at onpointradio.org. In a moment, we wrap up the week's news with Jack Beatty. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, a look back at the sounds of the week.
We must provide a framework for growth of a potential Palestinian state. There's got to be the framework for education, and health, and economic development, as well as security.
I think that it's still premature to discuss this issue, seeing that what we have to concentrate now is making every effort that the real reform will take place.
A suicide attack shattered a pool hall in the Israeli city of Rosh Hashanah late Tuesday, killing at least 15 people and wounding several dozen. The explosion occurred at 11:03 p.m. as Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon was meeting in Washington with President Bush.
Every time one of these events happens, it takes us off a course that we were on for a while, but I think it's a course that ultimately we have to get back to, because no matter how many military operations one conducts or how many suicide bombs are delivered, at the end of the day, we have to find a political solution.
The Palestinian gunmen came out one by one. They left their weapons in the church, went through a metal detector, were placed on buses, and as you mentioned, 13 then taken to the airport, 26 to Gaza. The clergy now are waiting to go into the church. The Israelis are waiting to pull out.
It's really scary. I have no idea what to do, what kind of precautions to take, because, you know, who thought that bombs would be in mailboxes? It's ridiculous.
But I would like to thank the Special Agent Paul McCabe of the FBI and the FBI, also the Sheriff's Department here, for making this visit with Luke possible so that we have a better understanding of what's going through his mind and what's happening. And I'm sorry, but that's all I'm going to have.
Cardinal Bernard Law is on the 12th floor of the Suffolk Superior Courthouse in a closed courtroom answering questions under oath about John Gagan. A judge is standing by near the courtroom ready to answer any legal questions. Cardinal Law arrived in a silver car with tinted windows. He was wearing his religious collar and a cross around his neck, but he made no comment.
Robert Hansen was sentenced to life in prison for what really was a despicable betrayal of his country. This brings to a close one of the darkest chapters in America's history.
And there's the week, Ariel Sharon and George Bush in Washington, suicide bombings back in Israel after the big push into the West Bank. Colin Powell saying a political solution is still required. The Church of the Nativity finally emptied after its long standoff. 18 pipe bombs in the Midwest. Lucas Helder, an American, held for that. His father talking about his son's crimes. Boston's Cardinal Bernard Law being deposed, and FBI mole Robert Hansen sentenced to life in prison. Jack Beattie, a lot bubbling this week.
Yeah, let's take Mr. Hansen. You know, the price of treason here, two Rolex watches and $600,000 in cash and diamonds. And for this, he turns in three spies who were killed by the Russians, and one of the spies was one of our best intelligence sources there. I mean, you just can't, someone called it the bargain of a lifetime. But two Rolex watches and $500,000.
Well, we've seen life go cheaper, but to sell security assets down the river at that price is expensive.
I suppose it's vulgar to wonder at the price, but you just have to. It's just incomprehensible to me. Hansen said, "I apologize for my behavior. I have opened the door for calumny against my wife and children."
Yeah, and that's not the only door he opened.
Yeah,
Ariel Sharon and George Bush getting into some new language here that's just begun to sink in the course of the week, talking about a framework for growth for the Palestinians, talking about reform. It's beginning to look like a euphemism for Yasser Arafat find another job.
Yes, the White House denied that when, of course, sources close to Sharon said that's what Bush had said, or that's what they took Bush to have meant. But it does look as if they're, you know, maneuvering around to have maybe a prime minister or something on the West Bank, and have Mr. Arafat as the symbolic president, as if somehow just his presence is just will not be accepted in any way by Sharon. And, you know, the week that began with the suicide bombing, it's ending now with Israeli troops massed around Gaza. We have the same pattern, don't we?
Yeah, the attack and the prepared counterattack, it now looks like. Of course, sorry, Jack?
I was just going to say, one Israeli opposition party member, UC Sarad of the Meretz, said it would be a serious mistake to fight in what is, in fact, the most densely populated area in the world. He says Israel must fight terrorism, but not on the backs of a civilian population.
Mm. At home, Bernard Law headed in to be deposed. Not the most glamorous day for a cardinal.
No, and, you know, the I do not recall, the do you recall if you were troubled by the information in this letter? I do not recall having seen the letter. Do you recall having written the note? I do not recall writing that note. And even though it's marked urgent, please follow through. Something is strange. This is the senior prelate of the Roman Catholic Church in America, and after all this scandal, he just fundamentally doesn't seem to get it.
It didn't sound like the bare breast of honesty, did it?
No, it didn't at all.
And then we have our own homegrown terrorist, I guess, Lucas Helder, 18 pipe bombs, and the FBI says he was planting them in the shape of a smiley face. This is unbelievable.
The indigenous American berserk. Isn't this something? I mean, every time you think you've heard it all about something weird that can happen in this country, you're topped by something like this.
The art student painting a smiley face across middle America with pipe bombs. Holy smokes. Jack Beattie, have a great weekend.
And you too, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. A great weekend to everybody. This is On Point.
This is